Chapter 25. When to Wear Jewels. Perrin strode impatiently up and down the flowered carpets that floored the tent, shrugging with discomfort in the dark green silk coat he had seldom worn since Fayil had had it made. She said the elaborate silver embroidery suited his shoulders, but the wide leather belt supporting his axe at his side, the one as plain as the other, only pointed up that he was a fool pretending to be more than he was. Sometimes he tugged his gauntlets tighter, or glared at his fur-lined cloak, lying across the back of a chair ready for him to put on. Twice he pulled a sheet of paper from his sleeve and unfolded it to study the sketched map of Malden while he paced. That was the town where Fahil was being held. Jundin and Get and Hugh had caught up to the fleeing inhabitants of Malden, but the only useful thing they had gotten was this map, and making anyone pause long enough to provide that had been a chore. Those strong enough to fight were dead or wearing Gaishine white for the Shido. Those who remained to flee were the old and the very young, the sick and the lame. According to Jundin, the thought that someone might force them to return and fight the Shido had quickened their steps north toward Andor in safety. The map was a puzzle, with its maze of streets and the Lady's Fortress and the Great Cistern in the northeast corner. It tantalized him with possibilities, but they were possibilities only if he found a solution to the greater puzzle that was not shown on the map, the huge mass of Shido surrounding the walled town, not to mention 400 or 500 Shido wise ones who could channel. So the map went back into his sleeve, and he continued to pace. The red-striped tent itself made him chafe as much as the map, and so did the furnishings. The gilt-edged chairs that folded for storage, and the mosaic-topped table that did not. The stand mirror and the mirrored washstand, and even the brass-bound chests standing in a row along an outer wall. It was barely light outside, and all 12 of the lamps were lit, mirrors sparkling. The braziers that had held off the night's freezing cold still contained a few embers. He had even had Fail's 2 silk hangings, worked with lines of birds and flowers, brought out and hung from the roof poles. He had let Lamgwin trim his beard and shave his cheeks and neck. He had washed and donned clean clothes. He had had the tent set up as if Fail were going to return any moment from a ride. Also, everyone would look at him and see a bloody lord. Look at him and feel confident. And every bit of it reminded him that Fail was not out riding. Tugging off one of his gauntlets, he felt in his coat pocket and ran his fingers along the rawhide cord tucked in there. 32 knots now. He did not need reminding of that, but sometimes he lay awake a whole night in the bedding that did not have Fail in it, counting those knots. Somehow, they had become a connection to her. Anyway, wakefulness was better than nightmares. "If you don't sit down, you're going to be too tired to ride to Soharbor, even with Niald's help," Berylaine said, sounding faintly amused. "Just watching you is exhausting me." He managed not to glare at her. In a dark blue silk riding dress, a wide golden necklace studded with fire drops tied around her neck, and the narrow crown of Mayenne holding a golden hawk in flight above her brows, the first of Mayenne was seated atop her crimson cloak on one of the folding chairs with her hands folded around her red gloves in her lap. She looked as composed as an Aes Sedai, and she smelled patient. He did not understand why she had stopped smelling as if he were a fat lamb caught in brambles for her meal, but he almost felt grateful to her. It was good to have someone he could talk to about missing Fail. She listened and smelled of sympathy. "I want to be here if, when, Gaul and the maidens bring in some prisoners." The slip made him grimace as much as the delay. It was as if he doubted. Sooner or later they would capture some of the Shido, yet apparently that was no easy matter. Taking prisoners did no good unless they could be brought away, and the Shido were only careless compared to other Aiel. Sulin had been patient too, explaining it to him. It was getting so hard for him to be patient, though. "What's keeping Arganda?" he growled. As if the Gildanin's name had summoned him at last, Arganda pushed through the entry flaps, his face like stone and his eyes sunken. He looked as though he slept as little as Perrin. The short man wore his silvery breastplate, but no helmet. He had not shaved yet this morning, and graying stubble grizzled his chin. Dangling from one gauntleted hand, a fat leather purse clinked as he set it on the table alongside two already there. "From the Queen's strongbox," he said sourly. He had said little the last 10 days that was not sour. "Enough to cover our share and more. I had to break open the lock and put 3 men to guard the chest. It's a temptation to the best of them, with the lock broken." "Good, good," Perrin said, trying not to sound too impatient. He did not care whether Arganda had to set 100 men guarding his queen's strongbox. His own purse was the smallest of the three, and he had gleaned every bit of gold or silver he could find to make it up. Slinging his cloak around his shoulders, he picked up the purses and brushed past the man out into the gray morning. To his disgust, the camp had taken a more permanent air, though it was not by design, and there was nothing he could do about it. Many of the Two Rivers men slept under tents now, pale brown patched canvas rather than striped red like his, but big enough for 8 or 10 men each, with their ill-assorted pole arms stacked at the front, and the others had turned their temporary brush shelters into sturdy little huts of woven evergreen branches. The tents and huts made at best meandering rows, not at all like the rigid lines seen among the Gildannon and Mayenners, yet it still looked a little like a village, with paths and lanes through the snow trampled down to bare frozen earth. A neat stone fire ring surrounded each of the cook fires, where clusters of men stood cloaked and hooded against the cold, waiting for their breakfast. It was what was in those black iron cookpots that had Perrin moving this morning. With so many men hunting, game was growing thin on the ground, and everything else was running out. They were down to searching for squirrels' hordes of acorns to grind for stretching the oatmeal, and this late in the winter, what they found were old and dried out at best. The sour mixture filled the belly after a fashion, but you had to be hungry to get it down. Most of the faces Perrin could see were watching the cookpots eagerly. The last of the carts were rattling through a gap made in the ring of sharpened stakes around the camp, the carrion and drivers swathed to their ears and hunched on their seats like dark sacks of wool. Everything the carts had held was stacked in the center of the camp. Empty, they lurched in the ruts left by the carts ahead, a single file disappearing into the surrounding forest. Perrin's appearance with Berlane and Arganda at his heels caused a stir, although not among the hungry Two Rivers men. Oh, a few made cautious nods in his direction. One or two fools gave rough bows, but most still tried not to look at him when Berlane was in the vicinity. Idiots. Stone-brained idiots. There were plenty of other people, though, gathered a little way from the red-striped tent, crowding into the lanes between the other tents. An unarmored Mayenner soldier in a gray coat came running with Berlane's white mare, bowing and bending to hold her stirrup. Anura was already up on a sleek mare, almost as dark as Berlane's mount was pale. Thin beaded braids hanging down her chest from the collar of her cloak, the Aes Sedai barely seemed to notice the woman she was supposed to advise. Back stiff, she peered fixedly toward the low Aiel tents, where nothing moved but the thin wavering lines of smoke rising from the smoke holes. One-eyed Galen, in his red helmet and breastplate and eye patch, made up for the Terrabanna sisters' inattention, though. As soon as Berlane appeared, he barked an order that stiffened 50 of the winged guards to statues, long red-streamered steel-tipped lances upright at their sides. And when she mounted, Galen snapped another command that put them on their horses so smoothly they seemed to move as one. Arganda directed a frown toward the Aiel tents, frowned at the Mayenners, then stalked over to where as many Gildannon lancers waited, in shining armor and conical green helmets, and spoke softly to the fellow who would be commanding them, a lean man named Kereyan, who Perrin suspected was nobly born from the haughty gaze visible behind the face bars of his silvered helmet. Arganda was short enough that Kereyan had to bend to listen to what he had to say, and the necessity frosted the taller man's face even more. One of the men behind Kereyan was carrying a staff with a red banner bearing the 3 6-pointed silver stars of Gildan, instead of a green-streamered lance, and one of the winged guards carried Mayenne's golden hawk on blue. Aram was there too, though off to one side and not ready to ride. Wrapped in his putrid green cloak, sword hilt rising behind his shoulder, he shared his jealous scowls between the Mayenners and the Gildannon. When he saw Perrin, the man's scowl turned sullen, and he hurried off, blundering through the Two Riversmen waiting for their breakfast. He did not pause to offer apologies when he bumped someone. Aram had grown increasingly touchy, snapping and sneering at everyone but Perrin as the days passed and they sat and waited. Yesterday, he had almost come to blows with a pair of Gildannon over something none of them could quite recall once they were separated, except that Aram said the Gildannon had no respect, and they said he had a bad mouth. That was why the former tinker was staying behind this morning. Things were likely to be touchy enough in So Harbor without Aram starting a fight when Perrin was not looking. "Keep an eye on Aram," he said quietly when Danil brought up his bay. "And keep a close eye on Arganda," he added, stuffing the purses into his saddlebags and buckling the flaps down tight. The weight of Berlane's contribution balanced his and Arganda's together very nicely. Well, she had cause to be generous. Her men were as hungry as anyone else. Arganda looks like a man ready to do something stupid to me. Steyr frisked a little and tossed his head as Perrin took the reins, but the stallion settled quickly under a firm, gentle hand. Dan'l rubbed his tusk-like mustaches with a cold, reddened knuckle and eyed Arganda sideways, then exhaled heavily in a mist.
"I'll watch him, Lord Perrin," he muttered, giving his cloak a hitch. "But no matter what you said about me being in charge, as soon as you're out of sight, he won't listen to a thing I say."
Unfortunately, that was true. Perrin would rather have taken Arganda with him and left Galen here, but neither had been willing to accept that. The Gildanin did accept that men and horses would begin starving soon unless food and fodder were found somewhere, but he could not make himself spend a day farther from his queen than he already was. In some ways, he seemed even more frantic than Perrin, or maybe just more ready to give in to it. Left to himself, Arganda would have been edging a little nearer the Shido every day until he was right under their noses. Perrin was ready to die to free Fael. Arganda just seemed ready to die.
"Do what you can to keep him from doing anything stupid, Dan'l."
After a moment, he added,
"As long as it doesn't come to blows."
There was only so far he could expect Dan'l to restrain the fellow, after all. There were 3 Gildanin for every 2 rivers man, and Fael would never be freed if it came to them killing each other. Perrin very nearly rested his head on Steyr's flank. Light, but he was tired, and he could not see any place ahead of him anywhere. A slow clop of hooves announced the arrival of Missouri and Seonid, with their 3 warders riding close behind, wrapped in cloaks that made most of each man vanish, along with part of his horse. Both Aes Sedai wore shimmering silk, and a heavy gold necklace, layers of thick strands, showed under the edge of Missouri's dark cloak. A small white jewel dangled onto Sionid's forehead from a fine golden chain fastened in her hair. Anura relaxed, settling more easily in her saddle. Back among the Aiel tents, the wise ones stood in a line watching, 6 tall women with their heads wrapped in dark shawls. The people of Soe Harbor might be about as welcoming to Aiel as the people of Malden would have been, but Perrin had not been sure the wise ones would let either sister come alone. They had been the last reason for waiting. The sun was a red-gold rim on the treetops.
"The sooner there, the sooner back," he said, climbing into the bay's saddle.
As he rode through the gap that had been made to let the carts out, 2 rivers men were already beginning to replace the missing stakes. No one lacked for wariness with Massima's people nearby. It was 100 paces to the tree line, but his eye caught movement, someone on a horse slipping away into the deeper shadows beneath the towering trees. One of Massima's watchers, no doubt, racing to tell the prophet that Perrin and Berlane had left the camp. No matter how fast he rode, though, he could not be in time. If Massima wanted Berlane or Perrin dead, as seemed likely, he would have to wait on another opportunity. Galen was not about to take any chances, though. No one had seen hide nor toenails of Santez or Gendar, Berlane's 2 thief-catchers, since the day they failed to return from Massima's camp. And to Galen that was as sure a message as their heads in a sack. He had his lancers spread in a sharp-eyed ring around Berlane before they reached the trees. And around Perrin, too, but that was only incidental. Given his wishes, Galen would have brought all 900 or so of his winged guards, or better yet, in his view, talked Berlane out of going. Perrin had tried that as well, with no better luck. The woman had a way of listening, then doing exactly as she wished. Fael was like that, too. Sometimes a man just had to live with it. Most of the time, since there was nothing else to do. The huge trees and stone outcrops sticking out of the snow broke up the formation, of course, but it was still a colorful sight, even in the dim light of the forest. Red streamers floating on light airs and slanted beams of sunlight, red armored riders vanishing momentarily behind massive oaks and leather leaves. The 3 Aes Sedai rode behind Perrin and Berlane, followed by their warders, all watching the woods around them, and then the man with Berlane's banner. Gareyan and the banner of Gildan came a little behind, his men dressed in neat shifting lines, or as near as they could manage. The forest's openness was a deception, and ill-suited to neat lines and bright banners, but add in embroidered silks and gems and a crown and warders in those color-shifting cloaks, and it was a most impressive sight. Perrin could have laughed, though without much mirth. Berlane seemed to sense his thoughts.
"When you go to buy a sack of flour," she said, "wear plain wool so the seller thinks you can't afford to pay any more than you must. When you're after flour by the wagon load, wear jewels so she thinks you can afford to come back for all she can lay hands on."
Perrin snorted a laugh in spite of himself.
It sounded very much like something Master Luhan had told him once, with a nudge in the ribs to say it was a joke, and a look in his eye that said it was a little more. Dress poor when you want a small favor, and fine when you want a large one. He was very glad Berylaine no longer smelled like a hunting wolf. At least that took one worry off his mind. They soon caught up to the tail end of the carts, a line that was no longer moving by the time they reached the traveling ground. Axe work and sweat had removed the trees, sheared off by gateways, and made a little clearing, but it was crowded even before Galen spread his ring of lancers around it facing outward. Fajan Neald was there already, a foppish Mirandian with his mustache waxed to points, on a dapple gelding. His coat would do for anyone who had not seen an Ashaman before. The only other one he had was black as well, and at least he had no collar pins to mark him out. The snow was not deep, but the 22 Rivers men led by Will Alcin were on their horses too, rather than standing and waiting for their feet to freeze in their boots. They looked a harder lot than the fellows who had left the 2 Rivers with him, longbows slung across their backs, bristling quivers and swords of various descriptions at their belts. Perrin hoped he could send them home soon, or better, take them home. Most were balancing a pole arm over their saddles, but Tad Alkar and Flan Barsteer carried banners, Perrin's own Red Wolf Head and the Red Eagle of Manetherin. Tod's heavy jaw was set stubbornly, and Flan, a tall skinny fellow from up to Watch Hill, looked sullen. Likely he had not wanted the job. Maybe Tod had not either. Will gave Perrin one of those open, innocent looks that fooled so many girls back home. Will liked too much embroidery on his coat at feast days, and he purely loved riding ahead of those banners, probably in the hope some woman would think they were his, but Perrin let it pass. He had not expected the other 3 people in the clearing any more than he had the banners. Holding his cloak around him as if the mild breeze were a gale, Balwer clumsily heeled his blunt-nosed roan forward to meet Perrin. 2 of Fael's hangers-on trailed after him with defiant expressions. Midori's blue eyes looked odd in her dark Tyran face, but then her coat, with its puffy green-striped sleeves, looked odd on her bosomy frame. The daughter of a high lord, she was every inch a noblewoman, and men's clothing just did not suit her. Lacian, Kyrianen and pale in a coat almost as dark as Niald's, though marked with 4 slashes of red and blue across the chest, was not much taller than she, and the way he sniffled with the cold and rubbed at his sharp nose made him look much less competent. Neither wore a sword, another surprise.
"My lord, my lady first," Balwer said in that dry voice, ducking a bow in his saddle, a sparrow bobbing on a branch.
His eyes flickered toward the Aes Sedai behind them, but that was the only sign he gave that he was aware of the sisters.
"My lord, I recalled that I have an acquaintance in this So Harbor, a cutler who travels with his wares, but he may be at home, and I've not seen him in several years."
This was the first time he had ever mentioned having a friend anywhere, and a town buried in the north of Altara seemed a peculiar place for it, but Perrin nodded. He suspected there was more to this friend than Balwer was letting on. He was beginning to suspect there was more to Balwer than the man let on.
"And your companions, Master Balwer?"
Berylaine's face stayed smooth inside her fur-lined cowl, but she smelled amused. She knew very well that Fael had used her young followers as spies, and was sure that Perrin made the same use of them.
"They wanted an outing, my lady first," the bony little man replied blandly. "I will vouch for them, my lord. They've promised to cause no trouble, and they may learn something."
He smelled amused, too. A musty smell, of course, coming from him, though with a touch of irritation. Balwer knew she knew, which did not please him, but she never made open reference to the fact which did. There was definitely more to Balwer than he let on. The man must have his reasons for taking them along. He had managed to take up all of Fael's young followers one way and another, and had them eavesdropping and watching among the Gildanen and the Mayenners and even the Aiel. According to him, what your friends said and did could be as interesting as what your enemies planned, and that was when you were sure they were your friends. Of course, Berylaine knew that her people were being spied on, and Balwer knew she knew that too, and she knew that he... It was all too sophisticated for a country blacksmith. "We're wasting time," Perrin said. "Open the gateway, Niald." The Ashaman grinned at him and stroked his waxed mustaches. Niald grinned too much since the Shido were found. Maybe he was eager to come to grips with them. He grinned and gestured grandly with one hand.
"As you command,"
he said in a cheerful voice, and the familiar silvery slash of light appeared, widening into a hole in the air.
Without waiting for anyone else, Perrin rode through into a snow-covered field, surrounded by a low stone wall and rolling country that seemed almost treeless compared with the forest he had left behind. Just a few miles from Soh Harbor, unless Niald had made a substantial error. If he had, Perrin thought he might pull those fool mustaches right off the man's face. How could the fellow be cheerful? Soon, though, he was riding west beneath a gray cloudy sky, along a snowy road, with the high-wheeled carts trundling along in a line after him, and early morning shadows stretching ahead. Stayer tugged at the reins, wanting to run, but Perrin held him to a steady walk, no faster than the cart horses could manage. Galen's Mayenners had to cross fields beside the road to maintain their ring around him in Barrelane, and that meant getting past the low walls of rough stone that divided field from field. Some had gates from one farmer's property to the next, probably to allow sharing plow teams, and others they jumped flamboyantly, with the streamers and their lances flying, risking their animals' legs and their necks. Perrin cared the less about their necks, in truth. Will and the two fools carrying the wolf head and the red eagle joined the Mayenner bannermen, behind the Aes Sedai and warders, but the other two riversmen strung themselves out flanking the line of carts. There were far too many carts for fewer than 20 men to guard, yet the cart drivers would feel easier seeing them. Not that anyone expected brigands, or Shido for that matter, but no one felt comfortable outside the protection of the camp. In any case, here they would be able to see any threat well before it reached them. The low rolling hills did not really allow a very long view, but it was farm country, with sturdy thatch-roofed stone houses and barns scattered among the fields, and nothing of wildness about it anywhere. Even most of the small thickets clinging to the slopes were coppiced for firewood. But it struck Perrin suddenly that the snow on the road ahead of him was not fresh, yet the only tracks were those made by Galen's foreriders. No one moved around any of those dark houses and barns. No smoke rose from any of the thick chimneys. The countryside seemed absolutely still and absolutely empty. The hair on the back of his neck stirred, trying to stand. An exclamation from one of the Aes Sedai made him look over his shoulder, and he followed Masuri's pointing finger north to a shape flying through the air. It might have been taken for a large bat at first glance, sweeping eastward on long ribbed wings, a strange bat with a long neck and a long thin tail trailing behind. Galen barked an oath and pressed his looking-glass to his eye. Perrin could see it well enough unaided, and even make out the figure of a human being clinging to the creature's back, riding it like a horse.
"Seanchan," Barrelane breathed,
both her voice and the smell of her worried. Perrin twisted in his saddle to watch the thing's flight until the glare of the sunrise made him turn away. "Nothing to do with us," he said. If Niald had made a mistake, he would strangle the man.